I think since everybody's here, we should get started. The tape kicks in at 15 after, but if it misses some of what I have to say, that's fine. You know. When Sunstone called me and asked if I would chair a session, I asked if I could chair this one because it looked so interesting. And I know both of the participants, have known them for years, going back to BYU, which is a long time ago now, isn't it? And I was thinking about my own thinking when I was young. My assumption was that there was masonry in the Book of Mormon and in the temple, thinking that masonry was ancient, so there was no problem. But then I learned that you can't drop that assumption into a conversation at BYU with a religion faculty because, of course, they assume it's a challenge to historicity. And then recently Mike Quinn has said that he doesn't find evidence for masonry. So I think that's opened up the topic again and forced everybody to take another look. So this should be quite interesting today. Let me introduce the speaker. Dan Vogel, I think, knows as much about Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon as anyone I can think of. He's written a book entitled Indian Origins and the Book of Mormon. Another entitled Religious Seekers and the Advent of Mormonism. I'm probably conflating titles here, but he's in the middle of a five-volume series of documents from the New York period and is working on a couple of other books at the moment. Blake Osler has been published widely in BYU Studies, Dialogue, the Society of Christian member of the Christian of the Society of Christian Philosophy. I'm not nervous, am I? I hope you guys do better. Religious Studies, published out of Oxford, the International Journal of the Philosophy of Religion from the Netherlands. Faith and Philosophy. He has been published in the anthology Line Upon Line, Essays on Mormon Doctrine. And is on the board of editors of the e-journal Element, which deals with Mormon philosophy and theology. I think I've missed a few things along the way there, but he's also an attorney with Burbridge, Osler, Carnahan, and White. Did I get that right?
Carnahan,
thank you.
Like it
I'm sorry. So, with that rather clumsy introduction, let's go on to the presenter, Dan, and then without any further introduction, afterwards the response.
All right. Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. Recently, Mormon apologists have challenged what many researchers have long regarded as obvious, that the Book of Mormon reflects the anti-Masonic controversy that pervaded Western New York during the late 1820s. A resemblance between Masonry and the secret societies described in the Book of Mormon is not obvious to some of its modern readers. It was especially obvious to many of the book's first readers, both Mormon and non-Mormon, who readily associated its warning of Latter-day secret combinations with the dreaded Masons. Despite the Book of Mormon's use of the term secret combinations, a favorite anti-Masonic epithet, for various reasons, several Mormon scholars have recently raised specific objections to the anti-Masonic thesis and, in some instances, offered alternative interpretations of their own. In particular, this essay will examine the arguments put forth by Richard L. Bushman, Blake T. Osler. In so doing, however, this essay will be not so much a defense of the anti-Masonic interpretation of the Book of Mormon as it will be an examination of the specific arguments made against that interpretation. I hope that what follows will both clarify the issues and raise the ongoing debate to a more productive level of mutual understanding. In responding to the apologetic arguments against the anti-Masonic thesis, for the sake of clarity and precision, I have elected to follow a point-for-point format. Time limitations, however, require brevity, The complete essay, along with several others, will be published by Signature Books sometime next year. Objection number one. Bushman argues that critics in Joseph Smith's day made so little of anti-Masonry in the Book of Mormon. In this argument, the first of several specious arguments from silence, Bushman incorrectly describes the true situation, for many in Joseph Smith's day did, in fact, identify the Book of Mormon's description of ancient secret societies and warning of latter-day secret combinations with Freemasonry. Alexander Campbell in 1831, E.D. Howe and Jason Whitman in 1834, and Edward Strutt Abdy in 1835, to name a few. Bushman is also incorrect that critics following Campbell in the 1830s neglected the point entirely, since they credited Solomon Spaulding with authorship. Howe, Whitman, and Abdy were subsequent writers holding an anti-Masonic interpretation of the Book of Mormon. Furthermore, Bushman's claim that the Spaulding theory completely overshadowed environmental explanations is untrue. Howe's 1834 book, for instance, presented both the Spaulding theory and environmental explanations for the Book of Mormon's origin. The two theories, despite Bushman's assertion, are not mutually exclusive. Indeed, advocates of the Spaulding theory usually believed that Spaulding's manuscript had been reworked by Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, or both. Objection number two. Speaking of first-generation Mormons, Bushman argues that the people who knew anti-Masonry in the Book of Mormon in the 1830s made less of the connection than critics today. The founding Mormons did make the connection, however slight one might judge it to have been, is an important point that Bushman should not have glided over too quickly. In March 1831, Ohio's Geauga Gazette quoted Martin Harris as saying that the Book of Mormon is the anti-Masonic Bible. So at least some Mormons had made the same connection between anti-Masonry and the Book of Mormon that anti-Mormons had. But given the fact that the two major anti-Mormon works, Campbell's 1831 critique and Howe's 1834 book, criticized the presence of anti-Masonry in the Book of Mormon, the Mormon silence following 1831 is remarkable and difficult to explain even for those, like Bushman, who reject the anti-Masonic thesis. Perhaps it was because they had no answer or, unlike modern apologists, did not perceive it as a problem. In similar fashion, Bushman asserts that converts paid no attention to anti-Masonry. Bushman does not explain how he knows the minds of so many people. But one should not make too much of this silence, since early Mormon converts also seemingly paid no attention to many aspects of the Book of Mormon, including its teachings on the Godhead, baptism, spiritual gifts, and church government. In fact, founding Mormons continued to live in a biblical culture and rarely referenced the Book of Mormon on any subject. Objection number three. Bushman complains that the groups labeled by Mormon as Gadianton were not one continuing society, like the Masons, but five distinct combinations that sprang up among the Nephites and Jaredites. Actually, the Book of Mormon describes the ebb and flow, or suppression and flourishing, of the Gadianton bands depending on the wickedness or righteousness of the Nephite nation. Bushman's assertion that Mormons used the term Mormons used the term Gadianton robbers was merely a convenient label for several distinct groups is incorrect, since succeeding robber bands claimed Gadianton as their founder and held the belief that their oaths were of ancient date and handed down. In this respect, the Gadiantons were not too unlike the Masons, who like to believe without evidence that their rites began with the building of Solomon's temple. Both groups therefore believe they were continuing societies, although the means of that continuity is not always clear. Thus, the Book of Mormon's treatment of secret societies is not as fragmentary as Bushman states. On the other hand, international Freemasonry was not as unitary as Bushman claims, since it was generally recognized that there were a number of distinctive orders and rites, as well as two competing grand lodges in New York itself. Ultimately, however, Bushman's complaint is irrelevant, since it was not imperative that Smith follow either a unitary or diversified history of Masonry. Joseph Smith, like any author, was free to adapt his cultural borrowings to the particular requirements of his own literary work. The historical and literary critic seeks evidence of environmental influence, not exact replication, unless, of course, the author is extremely unimaginative. Since an author uses his life's experiences to create something both familiar and unique, some differences, especially of traits not considered particularly distinctive, should be expected. Objection number 4. Bushman expresses surprise that the murder of the Masonic traitor William Morgan in 1826 had no equivalent in the Book of Mormon. Again, it was not imperative that Smith duplicate the Morgan murder in the Book of Mormon. By 1830, Morgan's murder had become less significant to anti-Masons, who were expanding their rhetoric to include accusations of other suspected Masonic murders. Nevertheless, the Book of Mormon describes the prophets being martyred at the hands of secret combinations and expresses the principle upon which anti-Masons believe Morgan's murder had been carried out when Moroni writes, "And whosoever those who belong to their band should reveal unto the world of their wickedness and their abominations should be tried, not according to the laws of their country, but according to the laws of their wickedness, which had been given by Gedianton and Kishkumen." Objection number 5. Bushman complains that in the supposed anti-Masonic passages in the Book of Mormon, nothing was said about Masonic degrees or elaborate initiation rituals. Bushman's complaint carries little weight, since the Book of Mormon repeatedly explains the omission. Moroni, for instance, states that he does not describe the oaths and combinations of the Jaredites, "for it hath been made known unto me that they are had among all people." Thus, it was unnecessary to repeat the secret oaths, because Moroni knew that his Latter-day readers were already familiar with them. Besides, a book purporting to be a history of Jewish migrants that gives scant details of their elaborate rituals and other religious customs could hardly be expected to record the rituals that were considered satanic. Objection number 6. Osler states, "A frequent charge against Masonry, also absent from the Book of Mormon, was that it displaced Christianity by being a religion itself. Book of Mormon bands of robbers were not a quasi-religious fraternity." It is true that in the early American Republic, anti-Masonic rhetoric focused on the fear that Masonry was attempting to replace Christianity by becoming a surrogate religion. But by the time Joseph Smith dictated the Book of Mormon, religious concerns were overshadowed by the agenda of the political anti-Masons. Following the apparent murder of Morgan in 26, anti-Masonic rhetoric focused on the institution's threat to civil liberties and free government. By the time of the 1828 election, Masonry had become a highly politicized topic as anti-Masons organized to prevent the election of Andrew Jackson. Religious concerns were not entirely displaced, to be sure, but civil and political arguments dominated anti-Masonic rhetoric. So one should not really expect to find the Gedianton robbers being described as a quasi-religious organization. Nevertheless, Osler's description of the Gediantons as a secular robber band is incomplete, since the Book of Mormon hints that the Gedianton oaths included religious elements. Mormon reveals that initiates of Gedianton's band, much like the Masons, entered into a covenant by swearing by their everlasting maker. Mormon also mentions that the Gediantons did not obtain the secret oaths and covenants from the Jaredite records, but rather they were revealed to him by Satan. However, given the nature of the covenants, it does not appear that the Gediantons would have agreed with Mormon regarding the source of their revealed oaths. Contrary to the negative portrayal of the Book of Mormon's prophets, the Gediantons undoubtedly viewed themselves differently. One of its leaders, for instance, declares that their works are good and of ancient date, arguing that they seek only to recover their rights and government. In light of the shifting emphasis in anti-Masonic rhetoric after the Morgan affair, one finds the Gadiantans described in the Book of Mormon as might be expected, that is, Book of Mormon prophets controverting the Gadianton self-image of being religious, just, and good, and portraying them as a Satan-inspired organization designed to destroy true religion and subvert free government. Objection number 7. Osler argues, nowhere in anti-Masonic rhetoric were Masons referred to as a distinct band of robbers. The Masons were never identified as a group which held out in the mountains and attacked as marauding robbers. The Nephites tried the robbers under martial law and assigned responsibility for dealing with them to the military. Americans looked to their civil sheriffs, and Masons stood trial in the usual criminal courts. Osler places undue emphasis on the wilderness condition of the Gadianton bands, since they did not originate in the wilderness, but rather began as a social subculture, attempting to infiltrate Nephite government by assassination, fleeing to the wilderness only under extreme pressure. However, despite Osler's assertion, the wilderness condition of Masonry was not a foreign idea. According to Masonic lore, before lodges were erected, the ancient Masons met in the highest hills and the lowest vales, and some Masonic lodges were themselves referred to as encampments. Whether in legend or metaphor, the wilderness imagery was there for Smith to expand upon. Osler is also incorrect to assert that Masons were not classed with robbers. The Wayne Sentinel in September 1828, for instance, alleged that Masonry's real object is anarchy and plunder. Anti-Masons attacked Masonry's attempt to gain unfair economic advantage over the uninitiated and frequently quoted Volney's statement that every association which has mystery for its basis or an oath of secrecy is a league of robbers against society. Joseph Smith may have transformed Volney's metaphor into dramatic fact, or he may have simply assumed Masons, when forced into the wilderness condition, would degenerate into robber bands for survival. Nevertheless, I believe Osler's argument in this matter is flawed and irrelevant. It is incorrect to read the Book of Mormon's description of ancient secret societies as a reflection of what was actually happening in Jacksonian America. To do so is simply to demand from the Book of Mormon something that it never says. Rather, the Nephite writers were warning Jacksonian Americans that what had happened in ancient America could also happen to them. Thus, Moroni warned readers to awake to a sense of your awful situation before they suffer the same fate as the Jaredites and Nephites. The Book of Mormon, therefore, was not describing for its first readers what Masons were actually doing, but analogously warning Jacksonian America about the secret fraternity's political and criminal potential. So one should not expect to find Masons forming into distinct bands of robbers holding out in the mountains and occasionally plundering small towns or being tried under martial law. Nevertheless, considering the 1828 election rhetoric regarding Jackson's early involvement with the Aaron Burr conspiracy in the Western Territories in 1806, which anti-Masons believed included a Masonic cover-up, the idea that plots to overthrow the government, or at least divide it, would initially form in the wilderness was not an altogether unrealistic expectation. While it remains unclear precisely what Burr's full intentions were as he plotted his Western coup, Burr gained lasting notoriety as a traitor, and Jackson's involvement, though perhaps innocent, hurt him in the 1828 campaign. Concerning the Burr conspiracy, anti-Masonic writer Henry Dana Ward declared in 1828, "The injury done to our national character by Burr's conspiracy was of the highest magnitude. The private correspondence of that conspiracy was carried out in the Royal Arch cipher, which is a proof that the agents were exalted Freemasons. This accounts also for their escaping the vengeance of the law. The evidence of their guilt was chiefly in the mystic characters of Freemasonry and the royal arch breasts, and thus closed against the search of human tribunals by profane oath and impious penalty of a royal archmason's obligations. Objection number 8. Quinn argues that the vast majority of anti-Masons had always seen Freemasonry as a strictly modern development, whereas the Book of Mormon claims that the secret combinations originated with Satan and Cain. Against Masonry's claim of divine and ancient origin, even describing Adam and other Old Testament patriarchs as grand masters, there were two possible rhetorical responses for anti-Masons. First, and the majority certainly followed this course, anti-Masons argued that Masonry had a strictly modern origin. Second, attempting to avoid what seemed like an unresolvable debate over the antiquity of Masonry, a minority of anti-Masons argued that the secret society originated with Cain, the first murderer. The two approaches were logical avenues of the debate and needed very little encouragement to be taken. Of course, as Quinn points out, for anti-Masons who chose the second path, it was more a rhetorical necessity than a sincere belief in the antiquity of Masonry. But in making this observation, Quinn moves too quickly to exclude the anti-Masonic thesis, for such rhetorical subtlety may have escaped Joseph Smith. If anti-Masonic writers separated fact from rhetoric, it does not necessarily follow that their audiences did. It is also possible that Smith, as an author of the Book of Mormon, was creating his own rhetoric for the sake of making his point. Regardless, the possibility that Smith employed anti-Masonic rhetoric in an anachronistic fashion should not surprise Quinn, since, more surprisingly, one can also find in the Book of Mormon evidence of a similar anachronistic approach to Christianity. Objection number 9. Quinn asserts, whereas anti-Masons typically claimed that Masonry was a fraternal organization dedicated to overthrowing Christianity and monarchy, the Book of Mormon repeatedly claimed that the main purpose of these secret combinations were to murder and plunder, and that the subversion of governments was necessary only for gaining power to protect these murders and plunders. In attempting to establish his occult thesis, Quinn wishes to draw attention away from the political context in which the Book of Mormon consistently describes the Gadianton bands. However, despite Quinn's apologetic, political objectives are a major feature of the Book of Mormon secret societies. In fact, one can find very little in the Book of Mormon to support Quinn's assertion that the Gadiantons infiltrated government only as a means of protecting their indiscriminate crimes. Of course, political power has the added benefit of protecting the Gadiantons from prosecution, which, incidentally, was a major feature of anti-Masonic rhetoric following the Morgan affair. Nevertheless, Quinn is wrong to portray the political goals of the Gadianton band as a secondary concern. If anything, secret combinations seek political power and riches and resort to murder and robbery as the quickest means of obtaining them. Regardless, the relationship between murdering, plundering, and gaining power is more complex in the Book of Mormon than Quinn seems willing to acknowledge, and the pursuit of political power and the overthrow of government are major Gadianton goals. Objection number 10. Rejecting Campbell's anti-Masonic interpretation, Bushman suggests that the Gadianton bands could with equal ease be perceived as modern terrorist guerrillas, dissenters at war with the old order, penetrating villages on the margins of official control, undermining from within, and attacking openly when they had strength. Viewed in context, the Masonic-like oaths and covenants were secondary to direct attacks on government through assassinations and military raids. Unlike Quinn, Bushman correctly places emphasis on the political context of the secret combinations, but unfortunately chooses to downgrade the importance of the secret oaths, which the Book of Mormon presents as an integral part of its description. The oaths and covenants of the Gadianton bands were central to their goals of murder, plunder, and infiltration, as well as to their cohesion and identity. Thus, Bushman cannot, with equal ease, apply the Book of Mormon's description of the Gadianton bands to modern terrorist guerrillas. Objection number 11. Osler speculates that the Jaredite and Nephite secret societies were culturally transmitted from the Near East, and Peterson repeatedly compares the Gadianton bands to Near Eastern robber bands. Osler's theory, I believe, is disallowed, at least in the case of the Nephites, by the Book of Mormon itself. The first secret society does not appear among the Nephites until about 52 BCE, nearly five centuries after settling in the New World. Furthermore, Mormon is careful to mention that these secret oaths and covenants did not come forth unto Gadianton from the records which were delivered unto Helaman. But behold, they were put into the heart of Gadianton by that same being who did plot with Cain. Thus, the Near Eastern comparisons of Osler and Peterson are irrelevant, at least as far as the claims of the Book of Mormon are concerned. Objection number 12. Rejecting the anti-Masonic thesis, Quinn argues that the Book of Mormon's prediction of latter-day secret combinations and secret murders is really a reference to witchcraft and occult murders. Rejecting the mountain of evidence in favor of the anti-Masonic interpretation as superficial, Quinn offers very little evidence in exchange for his occult thesis. He places a lot of weight on a well-established tradition that sorcery originated with Cain, and a separate and unrelated charge that the devil hath taught man sorcery or witchcraft, without explaining how such claims were brought together or found their way into a supposedly authentic ancient history of America. Significantly, unlike the anti-Masonic interpretation, Quinn can quote not one of its first readers who believed the Book of Mormon's secret combinations were references to the occult. The major flaw in Quinn's thesis, as I see it, is that he fails to place witchcraft and occult murders in the political and national setting required by the Book of Mormon. Obviously, the secret combination seeking to destroy the latter-day American government that Moroni warned of was something more pervasive and threatening than was witchcraft or the occult. Although, I should add, many religious anti-Masons regarded Masonry as an occult-like institution. Objection number 13. Peterson argues that one of the major difficulties of the anti-Masonic interpretation of the Book of Mormon is that in order to do so, one must see Joseph Smith as a vocal and committed anti-Mason in 1830, who then, only 12 years later, enthusiastically joined the Masons and, as some would have it, borrowed the most sacred rituals of his religion from them. Where, then, is the evidence of his alleged conversion from anti-Masonry in the late 1820s during the translation of the Book of Mormon to pro-Masonry in the 1840s when he was revealing the ordinances of the temple? There were perhaps several factors involved in Joseph Smith's decision to become a Mason, but given the political climate in the county surrounding Nauvoo, Illinois, he undoubtedly believed it was to his political advantage to do so. But Smith's conversion to Masonry, if it could be called such, was not complete, for soon after joining the Masons in 1842, Smith devalued the system by claiming it was only a corrupt version of his temple endowment. However, Peterson's apologetic is strange to say the least, for no matter what interpretation one holds of the Book of Mormon's secret combinations, whether anti-Masonic or otherwise, one must acknowledge Joseph Smith's inconsistency. Indeed, Peterson is aware of Smith's 1839 statement declaring the impropriety of the organization of bands or companies by covenant or oath by penalties or secrecies. Pure friendship always becomes weak in the very moment you undertake to make it stronger by penal oaths and secrecy. Joseph Smith's change of attitude with regard to the Masons did not go completely unnoticed, however, even among his own followers. Both Ebenezer Robinson and James C. Brewster commented on Smith's reversal, the latter equating the temple endowment with the Book of Mormon's secret combination. J. Joseph Smith's Masonic membership therefore poses inconsistency problems for all interpreters, not just those posing an anti-Masonic interpretation of the Book of Mormon. Ultimately, Smith is responsible for being inconsistent, and no one should feel compelled to create harmony where legitimate contradiction exists. If Smith reversed himself on the Masonic issue, it was not the only instance Smith subsequently reversed or substantially changed a number of Book of Mormon doctrines. The God nature of the Godhead and the duration of hell and punishment, for example. Objection number 14. Peterson believes that in Joseph Smith's day, the phrase secret combinations was simply a generic term, understood and applied broadly by Smith's contemporaries. Peterson therefore argues that the Book of Mormon's use of this term has no reference to any specific organization or group, but generally to guerrilla warriors. Peterson particularly attacks my assertion that at the time of the Book of Mormon's publication, the term secret combinations was used almost exclusively to refer to Freemasonry. In making this statement, I did not intend to imply that the anti-Masons had invented the phrase or that it could not be used or adapted in other similar situations, but that the context in the context of the 1828 campaign, the phrase had become politically charged. In other words, Jackson's opponents, especially in Western New York, incorporated the phrase into their stock of political buzzwords, so to speak. In this setting, the phrase secret combinations was anything but a generic term, and anyone attempting to use it in another context was certainly in danger of being misunderstood. Perhaps the best example of the anti-Masonic appropriation of the term comes from the Morgan Investigator, a periodical published at Batavia, New York, which declared in March 1827, "Beware of secret combinations. These are the dying words of General George Washington. Do not these words point with an index that cannot be mistaken to the Society of Freemasons?" Of course, Masons were quick to point out that Washington was himself a member of the fraternity and that he had only warned of combinations, not secret combinations. Anti-Masons had thus added to Washington's words to make it appear that he had been sympathetic to their views. In such an environment, the Book of Mormon's warning of secret combinations was an unmistakable reference to Freemasonry. To date, Peterson has been unable to locate a single non-Masonic reference to secret combinations that predates the Book of Mormon. Nevertheless, it is fruitless for him to search for the exception to the interpretive rule that clearly dominated Smith's cultural milieu. It is irrelevant what the phrase meant to others outside Smith's social, economic, or geopolitical environment. It only matters what it meant or probably meant to Smith and to his intended audience. To understand the language of the Book of Mormon, one must therefore search the literature of pre-1830 Western New York, something Peterson is unwilling to do. Objection number 15. Peterson argues the translation of the Book of Mormon did not occur in Palmyra, but rather, for the most part, in Harmony, Pennsylvania. In other words, for almost every dated Palmyra article commonly adduced, Joseph was 2 or 3 or perhaps even 4 days distant in an age that lacked telephone, radio, and television. But the fact remains that frantically anti-Mormon quotations from Palmyra newspapers have no clearly demonstrated direct relevance to the mind of Joseph Smith. Contrary to Peterson's assertion, Masonry was a subject extensively discussed in Palmyra newspapers before Smith's departure in December 1827. In fact, Smith left the area at a time when the excitement over the subject was quite high. New York had just completed its state and county elections, which in Smith's region was dominated by Masonic issues. In August 1827, Palmyra Baptist passed a resolution forbidding members from becoming Freemasons. According to historian William H. McIntosh, the Palmyra Lodge prospered till the Morgan excitement when their charter was surrendered to the Grand Lodge. So the community in which Smith lived was greatly impacted by Masonic issues even before his departure. The implication that Joseph Smith was cut off from all contact with Palmyra is also incorrect, having received frequent visits from family and friends, and on more than one occasion returned to his hometown prior to and during his dictation of the Book of Mormon. Nevertheless, the Masonic issue was not isolated to Palmyra, let alone Western New York. Even a superficial survey of the subject reveals that Masonry was a persistent and widely discussed issue dating back to the early days of the Republic. In fact, when one examines the early 19th century sources in New York, the New York counties of Ontario, Wayne, Seneca, Chenango, and Broome, as well as Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, it becomes quite evident that Masonry was a subject from which Joseph Smith could not escape. Nevertheless, Peterson has obviously missed the whole point of historical and literary criticism. Only the most unsophisticated researcher believes passages from Palmyra newspapers, or even the Susquehanna Register for that matter, represent the mind of Joseph Smith. Even if it could be demonstrated that Smith was in the vicinity of Palmyra or Harmony when a specific anti-Masonic editorial was published, it still would not prove directly relevant to Smith's state of mind, since it could never be proved that he read it, unless, of course, Smith was foolish enough to quote directly from it. However, Peterson's expectations are simply unrealistic, leading not only to a rejection of the whole field of literary criticism, but also to the creation of a closed system in which no negative evidence can be allowed. Regardless, most researchers have quoted the local newspapers not to prove Smith got his information from them, but rather as a sampling of the culture in which Smith lived. Indeed, literature, like any artifact, can only provide scholars with a partial reconstruction of a past culture. It is a sampling of a once dynamic larger whole. Therefore, any historical interpretation is necessarily developed from fragmentary information. Moreover, since newspapers were not the only sources of information, Smith could have learned about Masonry, anti-Masonry, and Jacksonianism through the more popular channels of information, such as community talk circulating in the country store and other public gathering places. Like any author, Smith's possible sources of information were not limited to the printed word, and hence they may perhaps be largely untraceable. So, historical and literary criticism can only make indirect connections between a work of literature and its cultural environment. Fortunately, scholars generally understand the limitations of their work and proceed cautiously, but not without significant results. Despite the efforts of Bushman, Osler, Quinn, and Peterson, anti-Masonry cannot be ruled out as a possible, if not probable, source of inspiration for Joseph Smith's narration of the Gadianton Bands. Indeed, in light of the present essay, the declarations of the apologists, particularly William J. Hamlin's statement that the supposed Gadianton Masonry connection has been debunked by Peterson, or John Gee's assertion that the anti-Masonic thesis has been conclusively demonstrated to be a mirage through Peterson's publications, are somewhat premature, if not extremely naive. In fact, Peterson barely dealt with the issues raised in my 1989 article, neglecting entirely its major thesis, which identified the Latter-day secret combination, singular, with the Jacksonians. I would therefore challenge the apologists to take a second, hopefully more careful, look at the anti-Masonic interpretation. Thank you.
It is my honor to be able to respond to my friend Dan Vogel with respect to the issues on which he has obviously spent a good deal of time writing and researching. I'm inclined to say that what's happening here is largely a matter of perspective. To give you an idea how that works, last night I was laying in bed thinking of the terrible situation of our United States, where literally 50% of all marriages plus end in divorce. And then it dawned on me, heck, the other 50% end in death, which is worse. So, you know, it could be a matter of perspective. I suspect that this may also be a matter of perspective. But before I begin on my theory, I want to say something that's truly worth listening to, if nothing else I say is. When this day is through, you won't get it back. And this is the only day that you have today to show your love to those that you love. So I challenge you to do it. And don't miss the opportunity, because when today's gone, the opportunity's gone. Now, with that advertisement having been taken place, let's talk about a different perspective. It's kind of, at least from my perspective, inaccurate to suggest that I suggest an anti-Masonic interpretation of the Book of Mormon. My theory is that the Book of Mormon indeed derives from an ancient document, but that in translation, necessarily, anyone adopts their vocabulary, their ability to express, and their knowledge in the translation. Having done some translation myself, I'm painfully aware of the limitations of my ability to render what is in the original language. To give you simply an example, the Hebrew word for grace, chesed. You could translate the Hebrew word for grace as grace, but I don't see that as an adequate translation because of the cultural richness of the term. I would really need to take about an hour to explain it to you. And indeed, I could write a whole book on the one word, and even that wouldn't be an adequate translation. So translation, in my view, requires explanation. It requires expansion. It requires further discussion to make what is there clear. Now, having said that, my view of the Book of Mormon is actually that when Joseph Smith ran across the Gadianton robbers and other combinations in the Book of Mormon, they in fact did remind him of Masons. Naturally, having the vocabulary of Masonic combinations readily at hand, he adopted his own vocabulary. I mean, what other vocabulary could he adopt? He only had his own vocabulary. So it was impossible for him to do otherwise. And so when I looked at anti-Masonry, my question was very simple. What is the better explanation? Is an explanation that these bands that we find in the Book of Mormon reflect Masonry? Or do they merely reflect a verbal affinity using special coined phrases like secret combination and oaths and covenants, with something really different underlying the text? I concluded, based upon my investigation, that there was something very different underlying the text. Moreover, whoops, it's a knife, don't get worried. Because of my theory, it's necessary not merely to look at 19th century America, it's necessary to take into consideration ancient sources as well. And in fact, I believe that in trying to figure out what the Book of Mormon is saying, two assumptions are made that just are not going to work. The first is that one can only look at 19th century America and make sense of it. I'm going to read a couple of statements to you. The chief executor of the oath spoke to Michael to disclose to him the secret names so he would memorize this secret name of his so that he could call the oath in order that they might tremble before it in the oath. He then revealed these to the children of the people and all the hidden things in this power of his oath. For it is power and strength itself. The evil one placed this oath in Michael's hand. Now that might sound something but that comes from 1 Enoch 69 and 13 through 15. And how about this? Semhaza, who was their leader, said unto them, I fear ye will not do this deed, and I alone will have to pay the penalty for this great sin. And they all answered, Let us swear an oath and bind ourselves by mutual promises, the word actually is covenants, not to abandon this plan, but to do this thing. Then they all swore together and bound themselves to this curse. And the curse was, in fact, to murder someone. Well, I'm taking that from the Enoch found in the fourth cave at Qumran. Wasn't available, actually, in Joseph Smith's day at all. Which is closer? I suggest that looking at the ancient world gives us very good clues. Now, I know that Dan has argued that we can't really take into consideration, for instance, what happens in ancient Jerusalem, because I believe, as he accurately states, the very first actual band of secret combinations that we meet is about 52 BC, when Kishkumen gives rise to a band of robbers who then go off into the mountains and create a separate society apart from the society in which the Nephite civilization lived. In fact, the robbers put on a siege, and they tried to starve out the Nephites. That's something the Masons never tried to do. Well, does that somehow suggest that it's irrelevant to look back to ancient sources? I suggest not. If he'd simply bothered to look at 2 Nephi 26 and 22 through 23, or 2 Nephi 10 and 15, he would have seen discussion in about 576 B.C. of secret combinations. And throughout the Book of Mormon, in fact, on my thesis, the question isn't really whether they're secret combinations, but whether they're marauding robbers. And I came up with 14 references to marauding robbers well before Kish Kuman's band, dating back as far as the Book of Jacob. So on my thesis, it's not secret combinations that's relevant. It's whether they're, in fact, this group of robbers that reflects the ancient Near East. Now, I simply want to point out something. There's additional evidence that I look to suggest that what I'm looking at is bespeaks something of the Near East. In Alma 37, it talks about a gazellum. Now, this is a non-biblical prophet that has a stone, and it reveals secret combinations and murders and robberies and plunderings. The interesting thing is that the Hebrew word for robbers is gazalan, and gazalam is a close cognate. So we have what would be the little robber receiving a stone that reveals robbers. It appears to me to be a play on words, but it's a play on words that's only possible in Hebrew and the cognate Egyptian word, actually. So, you know, I look at the text and say, look, to me this suggests something underlying the text that's ancient. I agree with Vogel to the extent that I think that the Joseph Smith had, you know, these robber bands reminded Joseph Smith of Masons because of the oaths they took and the fact that they were out to murder and rob. But what I actually find in the Book of Mormon is very different. Indeed, if we look at the Book of Mormon, I agree with Bushman. And in fact, it's not just Bushman and me anymore. If you look at Mark Thomas's new book, he in fact takes issue with Dan as well. And he agrees with me that what we have here is actually bands of robbers. And we'll be talking about that on Saturday. So what we actually have in the Book of Mormon are five separate bands. The first originated among the Nephites about 52 B.C., when Pahoran's three sons, Pahoran, Pekahmenai, and Paanki, all wanted to succeed him as chief judge. When Pahoran the second was chosen, Pekahmenai and his followers acceded, but Paanki and his supporters mounted a rebellion which ended with Paanki's execution for rebellion at a trial according to the voice of the people. I don't know how you'd do a trial according to the voice of the people, but that's how they did it. And then his followers hired Kish Kuman to murder Pahoran the second, and they entered into an oath not to reveal the identity of the murderer. And following the murder, Pekahmenai was appointed to chief judge. What happened later on, after they had established this combination, they had carried off an assassination, later on we find another band who found the plans, or who became aware of the plans of Kish Kuman. And they formed a new band. They were a band of robbers. But this band of robbers were essentially a separate group. I would analogize it more to a group like in Colombia, South America, where you actually have two societies. You have what I call the bandit society that deals drugs and has its own government, its own army, and by far the superior weapons. And then you have the legitimate, quote-unquote, democratic government. And they're at war with each other. In this one, the band of robbers was in the mountains, and they would come down from the mountains and they would raid into the villages. Now, I don't think it takes a lot of effort to suggest that's nothing that Masons ever did or were ever seen as doing. And the evidence that Dan points to, well, they were described as being in the mountains and in all of the lowest vales. Well, that's obviously just a reference to say that they were all over the place. Never. And I can't find any reference, and Dan apparently can't find any either, where the Masons formed a separate society, a separate culture, and they set up a separate army, and they besieged the villages, like Pancho Villa used to do, by the way. He had a separate robber band, and they would go into the villages and attack and rob and plunder and murder. And they had their own covenants, by the way, and if you left them, it was death to leave Pancho Villa's band. In any event, I find it a very interesting argument, because Dan has this kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't approach, because later on he explains that we really shouldn't even, after he's explained to us why we actually do believe that Masons are robbers and they're in the wilderness, he then goes on to explain why we shouldn't expect to find the Masons to be robbers and we shouldn't expect them to be in the wilderness, because that wasn't the way that you know, Joseph Smith actually was. Joseph Smith could have been creative. He could have embellished. He could have done something different. But that kind of misses the point of the argument now, doesn't it? Because what we're really asking is, do these bands look like Masons, or do they look like something else? And you can't have it both ways. They can't both be robbers in the mountains and not robbers in the mountains, as Vogel would have it. His argument simply doesn't work. In fact, it's an argument by crook and hook to get whatever, you know, to reach the conclusion, regardless of what the evidence actually is, as I see it. Now, I agree with Vogel to the extent that he disagrees with Quinn's occult thesis, and I think that he's done a yeoman's job of showing that Michael Quinn's occult thesis of the Book of Mormon in terms of its anti-Masonic explanation simply won't work. I now want to make some specific comments. How much time do I have?
5 minutes.
Okay. I now want to make some specific comments about specific arguments. He says that Martin Harris called the Book of Mormon the, quote, anti-Masonic Bible, and uses that as evidence that the book, that the early Mormons saw the different bands in the Book of Mormon as Masons. Well, that's simply not true. Martin Harris happened to believe that the Book of Mormon came from ancient records, and he believed that there truly were ancient bands like that. He didn't believe that they were actually Masons. What he believed was that it taught that secret combinations that were inspired by the devil are evil. And the Book of Mormon teaches against those. And to that extent, it's anti-Masonic, and to that extent only. I think that within context, to make the further argument that he's supporting the thesis that in the Book of Mormon we actually have a direct attack upon Masonry is absurd. Moreover, I would suggest, look at the clear prophecies, for instance, in 2 Nephi. If Joseph Smith is making this up, it's very easy for him to become very precise. There would be no reason for him to not take it on directly and expressly. He could even refer to it directly. And that's not what the Book of Mormon does. So I just don't see the evidence supporting Vogel's position. He takes on a very fine scholar, by the way, in my opinion. And I'm sure you would agree that Richard Bushman is a great scholar. Doesn't mean he can't be wrong. But he says that the groups labeled as Gadiant were not one continuous society, unlike Masons, but five distinct groups. Vogel says that they all claimed Gadiant as their founder, so Bushman is wrong. They were, in fact, a sort of continuing society. But this response is a non sequitur. Distinct groups can all take their inspiration from a common leader without being the same group. Look at the various Christian denominations. They're all inspired by Jesus Christ, but I'd hate to say that they're all exactly the same or that they all had the same beginning. Or look at various NBA teams, all inspired by the same game, but they're certainly distinct groups. In my reading, Bushman is correct on this point. I also want to get back to the point that he makes, but even if they are separate groups, it doesn't matter because Joseph Smith could have improvised. Well, here I think Vogel simply misses the dialectical situation. The situation is this. There are five of us now who've taken a look at what Vogel had to say and the argument that the Book of Mormon directly addresses somehow anti-Masonic issues. And my thesis, at least, is, you know, yeah, I see the coin words of anti-Masonry there, but that's not what underlies the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon is different than that. And what we're saying is the evidence is different than that. Well, Vogel is coming back now and saying, well, but the evidence is, you know, regardless of the evidence, this is the way that it is because Joseph Smith did the Book of Mormon and he lived in Palmyra and, you know, we're going to get every newspaper that we can find that ever came out in Palmyra and we're going to show you that it refers to Masonry. And we look at what he says refers to Masonry and we say, boy, I still don't see it in the Book of Mormon. What's happening in the Book of Mormon is different. It seems to me that in saying that it doesn't matter if they're separate groups, it might not matter on his view of the world because for him, he's already concluded that Joseph Smith is the author, lock, stock, and barrel of the Book of Mormon. For those of us writing from a different perspective, however, it does matter because, in my view, the evidence better supports the thesis that what we actually have is something different than Masonry with the coin and phrase words of Masonry used in the translation. He also takes on Bushman for saying that the Book of Mormon doesn't explain its elaborate rituals. And Vogel responds, but it doesn't matter because the Book of Mormon says why it doesn't explain those rituals, and that's because they were satanic. It's not going to explain them. But that actually doesn't grasp the argument that Bushman made. His argument was much broader. What he said is that the Book of Mormon does not describe Masonic characteristics such as elaborate rituals, degrees of initiation, competing orders and fraternities, legends of the Ark of the Covenant and Hiram Abiff, the mythic heroic figure of Masonry that were typical of the ridicule and anti-Masonic rhetoric. So what he's saying is there's a whole list of things that we would expect to be discussed if Masonry is really being discussed that just aren't there. Vogel picks out one, i.e. the rituals, and said, well, we wouldn't expect the rituals to be there. Well, what about the rest of the things on Bushman's list? He's violated what, at least in my profession, we call the rule of charity, and that is when you take on an opponent, you have to state your opponent's argument in its strongest fashion, and you state it in a way that your proponent, him or herself, would accept. Otherwise, you really don't make contact in the discussion and conversation of what your opponent is saying. I believe that Vogel would do well to go back and look at his paper and take into account the full argument that's actually being made. Having said that, I simply want to conclude by saying the Book of Mormon can be viewed from different perspectives. In my perspective, the evidence best supports the position that what we have is an ancient document translated by a person with a 19th century vocabulary and understanding. That's what the evidence supports. I think that Vogel discounts that and never takes it into consideration. Indeed, one would have to compare ancient literature in order to be able to make that comparison at all. And Vogel simply hasn't undertaken any of that kind of comparison. Now, that may not be his question, but I don't think that it's fair, at least within a certain community setting where he's taking on apologists, to assume that Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon and to use that as a sword in arguments without taking into consideration other arguments and perspectives that would make what he deems irrelevant to be relevant to their position. Again, let me say it's an honor to have been able to respond to Dan Vogel's work. I'm pleased that I know him, and I'm pleased to call him my friend. Thank you.
Ten minutes for questions. Could you direct them, please, to the person you would like to respond? And could the person responding please repeat the question for the tape? Thanks. Brent.
The Book of Mormon is anything other than anti-Masonic. Well, just one.
Okay. First of all, it wasn't really an issue as to whether it was anti-Masonic except for anti-Mormons. I've already explained why taking Barton Harris as supporting that position is simply not accurate. That's not an accurate description of his position.
I think that's absolutely inaccurate that you would even suggest that.
Okay.
This is the language, anti-Masonic Bible. I mean, I'll just go with what he said.
Okay, so will I. And and may I add, it's not really contrary to my thesis either, Brent. So, you know, if you think you're arguing with me, which maybe you want to do, we don't have anything to argue about.
But my goal was not to prove the Book of Mormon was anti-Masonic, but to judge the validity of the arguments against the anti-Masonic thesis. I just don't find them very persuasive. I mean, I could take them one by one again.
And may I, for that reason, because we're dealing with his arguments against those who he calls apologists, and there are apologists and then there are polemicists. There's a big difference. And it may pay to make the distinction. But in the bottom line, you know, there are those of us who don't find those arguments for anti-Masonry very compelling. And I've given lots of evidence from the Book of Mormon itself why the Masons don't look like what's in the Book of Mormon. That's the evidence. And there are five, and I just said that there are five of us who disagree with him. You want to say that there are five people earlier on who agree with Dan. And that's not true because Dan is taking on apologists who have written arguments. They couldn't possibly agree with Dan because none of those arguments had even been made when they were alive. That's how I see it. Brent.
Well, I just want to reemphasize a couple of theoretical things with the discussion that a lot of less precise people try to use. And one is that there's two things going on in the Book of Mormon. One is it warns of latter-day secret combinations for the people in America to watch out for the secret combinations seeking to destroy their government. And the second, complete kind of different issue is the ancient Gadianton robbers and what the relationship of that is to the latter-day group that the Book of Mormon's warning about. The Book of Mormon does not say, or neither do I say, that Joseph Smith is saying that the Gadiantons are Masons. He's not saying that the Gadiantons are Masons. Masons are the Masons. And there's many other groups like the Masons that have these same secret oaths. The book, what I'm arguing is that Joseph Smith used the latter day group as a model for the earlier group. Not that he's saying that the Gadiantons are Masons. And the second issue is the Gadiantons to be doing what the Masons are doing. The Gadiantons are Nephite and Lamanite groups, and they're B.C. and A.D., but there's no imperative reason for Joseph Smith to copy the Masons into his book if that's what he did. So it's warning the latter-day readers that what happened in ancient America, that the Gadiantons and the secret combinations destroyed their society, is about to happen in America. And to take warning and to turn from their course. My argument in my 1989 article was that the Jacksonians had just gotten into office. The anti-Masonic rhetoric, the posters and billboards at the time called Jackson's party the Masonic party in politics. And Jackson, as the hero of New Orleans, was a lethal leader in their minds to this Masonic group.
Now, maybe I can actually respond to what Brent had to say. Sometimes it makes me feel like the lady who approached Churchill at a state function, and she said, "Mr. Churchill, you're drunk." And Churchill stammered, "Yes, madam, I may be drunk, but you're ugly, and tomorrow I shall be sober."
Yeah, it's time.
Okay.
Yes, that's the consensus we're going. Thank you very much, and thank you to both.
Good to see you.
Yeah.